Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We are talking automotive maintenance and repair this afternoon. Here to do just that, Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive Incorporated, an independent repair, auto body, towing, and used car facility in Hoosick, New York. Gordon has been in the biz going back to the late 70s, and he knows his stuff. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Gordon, I would say, is an expert on German and European cars, but he brought an American car today, and boy, what a car it was. Why don't you tell us what it was?
Well, it's not your average American car. It's a 1965 Buick Riviera.
Oh, and, you know, I was lucky enough to get a ride.
Yeah, Ray got a little dose of the car today, and although we didn't get to open up all the four barrels completely, it did go quite nicely.
You opened them up enough to turn the heads of many people on Central Avenue here in Albany.
Yeah, cops chase us in the parking
lot. No, that's not true. No. Now, I did tweet a picture of this. It's at WAMC Vox Pop if you want to check it out. A beautiful Grand Sport. Grand Sport, 1965 Buick Riviera. Yeah, that's when they made cars. That is when they made cars. Let's go right to the phones. We have a full bank of calls. Once you hear a call hang up, that's your cue to call. Joe in Middletown. Joe, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I have a question about tire inflation. I dutifully, religiously fill my tires based on the panel that's inside the front door. 29 pounds on the front, 28 pounds in the rear. It's a Subaru Impreza Outback Sport, small compact car. Every time I get the oil changed or if I take it to my mechanic for other work, no matter where I get the car serviced, everybody thinks they're doing me a favor by giving it back to me with about 35 or 40 pounds of pressure in all the tires. Even when I ask them not to do that, and some of them claim, well, you need to fill the tires based on what the tire says on its wall. So if the wall pressure says maximum, on the wall of the tire says maximum pressure, 42 pounds, that's what you should be filling it at. Manufacturer says 29 pounds. Everybody, all these other guys say 40 pounds. What is the deal there?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Joe.
What do you say?
Yep. Here's a straight story. What you're reading on the side of the tire is maximum inflation for maximum load. So if that car, or let's say it was a pickup truck, was going to be fully loaded, then you could put that much pressure in the tires to handle that load. Ordinarily, under normal load, the plaque on your where you open the door will give you the normal tire pressures, and that really is what you should go by, unless, like we said earlier, you're loaded for some reason. The tire manufacturer's pressure chart, you can go a few pounds over that, and the reason I say that is, a few pounds over that will give you slightly less rolling resistance, give you maybe a hair better gas mileage, less heat buildup in the tires. They might last a little longer. And but if that answers your question, it has to do with max load or just normal driving conditions.
And what do you do?
I take the information on the car, and I usually add a couple pounds to it.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks for your help.
Joe, thanks for starting us off today. Gordon Fricke is our guest. We talk cars about every month or so. Dennis and Saugerties, you're next.
Good afternoon. Thanks. I'm about to lose the radio or phone here, so I'll make it real quick.
Okay.
I have a 94 Honda. Whenever I'm driving...
Oh, this is bad.
Whenever I'm driving between... in 46 miles an hour, the front right corner of the car seems to shake a lot. The smoother the road, the straighter the road, the more likely it shakes. I've changed tires. Just listening to the last call, I've checked the tire pressure religiously. I did at one time have the front left axle replaced, but every time I go into a mechanic, they say, oh, it's fine, we took it out for a ride and nothing, everything's fine. But it shakes like crazy, the better the road that I'm on.
Huh. Okay, Gordon?
Does the shake continue the faster you go, or does the car...
No, as soon as I take my foot off the accelerator, the shaking will stop.
Okay. That's interesting, because I write an article for the Bennington Banner, and yesterday's car care section, my article was on shakes and shimmies. And your car shimmy or shake falls into the drivetrain category, because the key that you, what you just mentioned at the very end of your description of the problem is, the minute you take your foot off the throttle or the gas, the shake stops. That pretty much eliminates wheels and tires and all the things that can be out of balance and out of round, and now that takes you to drivetrain. So in a case of your car, the drive axle would be under suspicion, and that's what I would look to possibly solving that problem.
Now, is the drive axle the front right or front left?
Well, you have two of them. There's one going to each drive wheel on your car. And, and if there's something wrong with the drive axle, whether it's bent, let's say you got pulled out of a ditch one winter and somebody just grabbed anything they could, you could have a bend in the axle, and or the joints on either end of it could be having trouble. So I got a feeling that's where your problem's going to lie.
All right.
Super, super. Thank you very, very much.
Hey, Dennis, thank you. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Gordon Fricke, our guest on Vox Pop. Larry in Hancock, New York, you're on.
Okay, I got two questions for two cars.
Okay.
The first one is a 2005 Saab 92X Aero. It's the Subaru.
Subaru?
Yeah, it's basically a Subaru Impreza WRX.
I see, I see. You're being clever. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, with that car, the power steering, I'm getting a groan on low-speed turns with I'm nowhere near steering lock. And I'm not sure what the cause is, whether it's a bad pump or a bad rack. Tire pressures are well-maintained. And my mechanic doesn't really know either. We've flushed the fluid. It gets better, but for a short period of time.
Okay, so I think
it's temperature related. It's worse when it's warmer.
The warmer it is, the worse it is.
Yep.
All right. I'm sure it sounds like the fluid level has been checked probably many times. How many miles are on this car?
93,000.
Okay. I mean, that's not a tremendous amount of mileage. And then this car is a Subaru and Saab clothing or however you want to term it, but which is not a bad thing. Subaru makes a great car. What the temperature thing makes me think that the hotter it is, the thinner the fluid gets. And the thinner the fluid gets, if there is something getting a little bit tired in the power steering system, potentially the hotter and thinner the fluid is, the more the chance of it whining or groaning could be.
Now, it's more of a groan.
Now, does the car have to be rolling, or if you just turn the wheel with it running, will you get that noise?
It has to be rolling.
You have to be moving?
Yes.
Your problem may not be related to the power steering then, because if it only occurs when you're in motion, you got other things going now. You've got your whole drivetrain is running. Would you call it almost like a chucking or almost a resistance to turn around the corner?
I do feel a little bit of a chuffing through the wheel, but if I back off on how hard I'm turning, it does get somewhat better.
Okay. Subaru has had somewhat of an ongoing issue with some resistance when you're taking sharp turns, slow speeds, like in a parking lot or going into a parking space. Your car, I'm sure it's an automatic.
No, it's a standard.
It is a standard. Okay. Your car has basically a couple of differentials, and one of them is between the front axles, one is between the rear axles, and then there is a unit that transfers the power from the transmission to the rear drive shaft to operate the back wheels. And in because yours is a manual transmission, this is a little touchier, but and the ones with automatics, there was a bulletin to change the transmission fluid, and then you add about a quart of a slipperier fluid, and they used to recommend Chrysler's ATF Plus 4, and that took the resistance out of the drivetrain. But yours being a manual, it could be in the unit that's at the back of the transmission that helps split that torque between the axles. So you could have a bit nasty of a problem occurring. In this case, I would get it checked out more thoroughly before you go too crazy with it. And it's not that harmful of a condition, but it may never change.
Larry, did you get any of that? He might as well have been speaking Mandarin for all I know.
Yeah, I understood that.
Oh, good.
The other one I think might be a lot simpler. I also have a 95 Audi S6. The air conditioning kind of petered out at the end of the summer. I was able to use a adapter for the low pressure sensor and tried to fill the system, and it didn't seem to really improve the air conditioning much.
Yep.
And I know Audi does, the Audi method would be to do that full flush and all that. I'm pretty much stuck doing that.
Yeah. The only way to recharge air conditioning nowadays is to get it on the correct equipment where you will completely evacuate the system. So it's down to a vacuum, and then you recharge it with the exact correct amount.
Okay.
And that gets weighed in by a scale.
All right, Larry, we got a break here. I apologize, but we have to take a short break and be back with Gordon Fricke and more of your calls at 1-800-348-2551. More.
Support for WAMC comes from the Ashokan Center, Olive Ridge, New York, a classroom in the wild helping schools, organizations, and individuals reconnect with nature, history, and the arts. AshokanCenter.org. Vision Excel Eye Care, Lake Katrine, New York, providing eye exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, glaucoma management, and specialty contact lens fitting. 845-336-6310. The Rhinebeck Artist Shops, providing professional picture framing, fine art materials, gifts, and cards for over 30 years in Rhinebeck and at their expanded store in New Paltz, RhinebeckArt.com. And Munson Williams Proctor Arts Institute, Utica, New York, featuring Shadow of the Sphinx, Ancient Egypt and Its Influence, MWPAI.org.
During the fun drive, I remember somebody called in and said, I'm an English teacher. I don't like the way Graf says car on the show. Car. I don't know how I can improve it. I guess I could do the Hempstead way. Car. Hey, that's a nice car you got there.
Or try Boston. Car.
Car?
Yeah.
Car is, that's all I got.
Carro? What's that, Spanish?
That's very good. All right, you know, let's just go back to the phones. And Jim in Central Connecticut. Jim, you're on.
Hello, how are you today?
Hey, welcome aboard.
Well, thank you for taking the call. I'm a friend with a 2004 Monster Tribune, the little sport you. They've been complaining about a funny grumbling noise coming from the front end and a bit of a shifting as you drive. The car has almost 200K. However, they have already put in front struts, R&R front struts, and rear shocks. Just recently, they got new tires on this thing. Brakes are good. They were replaced the front pads when they did the shock struts. Well, the car with almost that kind of mileage, is the front hub bearings starting to be a concern with that kind of shifting around?
Oh, yeah, that's an issue at much lower mileages on a lot of vehicles nowadays. When you say, does the noise change when the car goes through curves or you shift the weight left to right going down the road?
It does feel to the driver like it is shifting a bit left to right. They thought they almost had a loose tire or something, and they found they did, the tire shop or front end alignment shop. I'm surprised the front end people didn't catch it. But anyways, after that, she still notices this shifting, and it's been an ongoing thing. And I suggested about a year ago that it might be hub bearings on their way out. Now, can you buy those modular, like with the GM product? You take a few bolts after you disassemble the brakes and all of it. You undo a few cap bolts, and the whole hub comes out, and you put a whole new hub in, everything?
Yeah.
Or do you have to pull it all apart and replace the bearings and whatever?
It depends on how the vehicle was manufactured. A lot of cars today have exactly what you're talking about. It's a bolt-in hub and bearing assembly. that particular Mazda Tribute, which is the same thing as a Ford Escape.
It's an Mercury, whatever they call it.
Yeah. Has a press-in bearing, to the best of my knowledge. So it's not as easy as the bolt-in. But at that mileage, I'd be astonished that they are the originals. And if they are, that's great. But I think it probably could definitely be a front-wheel bearing issue.
Okay.
Okay, so that sounds pretty good for that. I will pass that along to these folks. They put a lot of mileage on it, and they run that car all over the place.
All right, fair enough.
They really depend on it.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call.
You have a good day now.
You too. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Let's see. It's Bennett's turn in Newburgh. Bennett, you're on.
Yes, hi. I'd love to get your take on two bits of advice that a friend of mine, a self-professed auto whiz, gave me. I'm an confessed automotive ignoramus, but I sense there's something wrong. Anyway, here are the two things he told me. One, I would benefit from putting high test gas in my 2005 Sienna, despite the fact that the recommended is just a regular. That's number one. And number two, he tells me that I should change the oil every 3,000 miles, again, against the manufacturer's suggestion of 5,000 miles. Is he right about either or both of those things?
Okay.
All right. The as far as the gas goes, you kind of bleeped out for a quick second, but you like to put in high test in spite of the manual saying you don't have to?
No, he wants me to.
Oh, okay.
I put in regularly. He's telling me that if I put in high test, I'll make up for the extra price of the gas by better mileage and a longer engine life.
Yeah,
and that doesn't sit well with me.
In the case of the gasoline in your vehicle, you're not going to benefit by putting high test in that vehicle. And if the car called for it, then you should stick to at least the minimum octane rating that they're recommending. In your case, you don't have to do it, and I don't think it's going to really provide you with any benefit. So the oil changes, that comes up a lot. What type of driving do you do? Is it beautiful, commuting, easy mileage, no short trips, no idling, no change of seasons, no snow?
Nobody does that.
Yeah, no, it's mixed. A mix of highway and little backcountry roads.
Yep.
I don't do a lot of inner city driving, real heavy stop and go driving, but a lot of, traffic lights on back roads kind of thing.
Yep. That 3,000 mile change interval is still pretty appropriate for our part of the country because of, like what I spoke of earlier, all the variety of driving, the idling, the change of seasons, hot weather, cold weather. Some of the car makers are going to really long extended change intervals. Most of the time, that's with the use of full synthetic oil and near ideal driving conditions.
Yeah.
Could you go a little over the 3,000? Maybe, but I wouldn't go too far over it with conventional motor oil and average driving. It's very cheap insurance.
Well, thanks. I mean, so it was half.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was half.
I'll have to tell him we're halfway at least.
Well, fair enough, Bennett. Yeah, kind of a rough connection there on your phone, but we got it, and thank you very much. So, that brings up a point about the premium gas and then the regular gas. Oops, I just turned your headphones up. I apologize. I'm trying to turn mine up. There's the middle-grade gas.
Yep.
Either you need the regular or you need the premium. Why do you need an 89-octane?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. If you look, a lot of cars have on the gas door, if you have a gas door, it'll tell you what the minimum octane rating is that the manufacturer's looking to have you put in there.
Yeah.
And a lot of European cars, they're saying minimum 91.
Right.
You can't get 91 at a lot of stations. It goes 87, 89, 93.
Yep.
So if you've got a super expensive European car, you're going to go to the 93 because
right.
You don't want to go to the 89 because you're supposed to have 91. So that's probably a great somewhat ploy of the stations to upsell the premium. But if the car was built to run on 87 regular, that's all you need.
Hmm.
There's no major benefit to going to, quote, high test unless you have an engine that's designed for the higher octane gas, higher compression.
Yeah.
Like the Buick you were just in, that's high compression. It's, I think, 10.5 to 1. So in the day, they're saying use what they call it back then, super, I guess.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So, I mean, how many miles per gallon do you get on that thing, by the way, that 1965 Buick Riviera?
It depends on how hard you push that pedal on the right. Could be lower than 10 in certain instances.
But on the highway?
You know, I don't know. I've never checked it. 15, maybe?
Well, that's all right. You're living in style. Michael in Richmond, you're on. Michael.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Good.
I own a 2008 Nissan Frontier with four-wheel disc brakes with 39,000 miles on the truck, and my rear pads are, I'm told, are just about gone. And I'm wondering if I can simply put in new pads and not deal with turning the rotors. There's no vibration or pulsating in the pedal. But you know how you get the buildup on the shoulder of the pads? You get like a rust buildup.
Yep.
I'm wondering if, you know, simply putting new pads on, they'll just seat themselves to those discs and I'll be fine.
Well, here's what'll happen. That rust that you're seeing creeping in from the edges and from the inside out, that will continue. And we get a lot of cars in that the actual surface area, you know, the shiny part of the brake rotor has diminished to almost nothing in some cases. In some cases, it's just solid rust. And that's a bad braking surface. The ability for that wheel to stop is greatly decreased.
Okay.
You really should replace the rotors when you replace the brake pads. Unless they are absolutely perfect.
Oh, I see. And what about turning them? I guess.
Well, that used to be a very common procedure.
Right.
And it's almost non-existent now. And the reason being is two things. The rotors are starting out life very thin to begin with. There's not a lot of built-in metal that you can machine out of them to get the surface back. You make them too. Then you're going to cut them way too thin.
Okay.
And because of the rust situation, you probably never machine it all out. So you're starting out with a partially rusted rotor from the very beginning, and it's only going to get worse. Mm. Rotors have come way down in price, you know, from what we had 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So you really just do it right and do it the first time and replace pads and rotors.
And what are your thoughts? Can I go to an aftermarket rotor?
Sure you can. Yeah.
No big deal there.
No, go. You know, go to a good auto parts store and tell them what you're working on and what you'd like, and they'll give you some different options. And you'll be fine.
All right, Michael. Yep. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Vox Pop on WAMC, the automotive show. Gordon Fricke is our guest, as he is once a month. Let's go to Ellie in Woodstock. Ellie, you're on.
Hi, Gordon. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My son just drove his 1998 Nissan Altima from here in upstate New York down to Texas. We had it checked out pretty well before he left. When he got there, he went to get the oil changed, and the guy at the shop said he needed a snake belt, which sounds like something that was outlawed years ago.
Very nice.
I never even heard of it. There he is in a, you know, strange town and his New York plates, and I'm wondering, you know, what is it, and how would he know if he actually really does need one?
Well, you see, that's specific to only Texas and those states where there's a lot of rattlesnakes.
Now, well, that's the serpentine belt?
There you go, Ray.
Okay.
Ray's got it. Yeah,
I never heard of that either.
Yeah, it's commonly referred to a serpentine belt because it goes around all these pulleys, and it kind of resembles a snake, you know, when it goes across the ground. You know, it's going around all the pulleys. The proper term is nowadays it's called the drive belt, because it turns your accessories, your alternator, your power steering, air conditioning compressor. But yeah, they were referring to the serpentine belt or drive belt.
Okay.
And it is extremely important, because if that belt breaks, there's only one belt on a car like that. So if you lost that belt out in the middle of nowhere, you're done. You can't drive anymore.
Right.
So and they're not that expensive, so it's definitely a good thing to have done.
And they're fairly easy to, you can tell when they're worn, right?
Yeah, you look at them, you look for cracking or fraying, you know, if they just look like they're have had it. You know, very, very common item to replace. Very big wear and tear item.
Yeah.
They gave him an estimate, you know, between $200 and $300. Does that sound right?
That's way too much.
Too
unless
much.
Unless
right.
they were referring to another belt that is called the timing belt. That's,
no, I've heard of that, and I would know, yeah.
Unless this belt, the serpentine belt, needed other things, like maybe some of the pulleys were worn out and falling apart, I would get more details, because that's too much money for a serpentine
even
belt.
Even with labor?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah, so it should be more in the range of what, would you say?
If it was $100 or maybe slightly lesser in that range, that would be more realistic.
And add 50 for the New York plates. You're
yeah, well, that's what you got to watch out for.
All right, Ellie, thanks a lot. Good luck.
Thank you.
You know, so the serpentine belt is made to replace all the belts, right?
Yes.
So what's the advantage if you have to replace one more expensive belt than, oh, I need a new belt for my, you know, my alternator?
Well, years ago, you had individual belts, and some cars had four. You had one for the power steering, maybe one for the alternator and water pump. You may have had another one for the air conditioner, and then air pumps came on, so you might have had a fourth belt.
Yeah.
And they were called V-belts, and they needed to be adjusted. They got noisy. They squealed. You notice you don't hear that anymore?
Yeah.
This so-called serpentine belt has usually 4 to 7 little teeny V-grooves in it. And it's wide and flat.
Yeah.
They basically never slip or squeal. They mostly have now automatic tensioners to keep them tight. It's a great improvement.
So you're for this?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. And John in New Paltz, you're on with Gordon Friggy.
Yeah, hi. I have a 2002 Jeep Liberty. And we recently have had it in the shop fairly often. There's a clinking that happens. You can almost feel it underneath the driver's side. It was occurring when we would turn, and it would occur sometimes when we brake. Also, so we took it in, and we had the transmission replaced. Several days after having the transmission replaced, the clunking had not subsided at all. The mechanic acknowledged that the clunking was still there. He wasn't sure what it was. We drove it out with the new transmission, got it about 30 miles away, and it broke down again. We had the water pump replaced, and he gave it back to us once again, commenting that the clunking was still there, but that he felt the car was safe, and that he and several other mechanics had it up on the lift and couldn't figure out the source of the clunking. So I'm wondering if you know what that might be, and also if you think the car is in fact safe. We have a 3-month-old that we need to drive around in it.
Okay, now I should point out that any advice he gives along those lines, not legally binding, you know.
Right. Of course. Sure, yeah.
All right.
Now, this noise, are you hearing it from the front end, do you think?
You know, it feels to me like it's happening directly underneath the driver's side of the vehicle. I can almost feel it under my feet. So it would be, yes, I suppose, towards the front.
Okay. Now, these other repairs, these were not necessarily attempting to solve that clunk, were they? I mean, were other things just going wrong? Or were these all attempts to solve that clunk?
No, there were other things going wrong, and we thought the clunk was probably symptomatic of those other things and would subside once the other things were fixed.
Okay. There was an issue with Jeep Liberties with ball joints in the front end.
Those were actually also replaced when the transmission was done. Initially, we referring to the clunking, he thought that it would be the ball joints, and then when he went in to repair the ball joints, the transmission also needed to go, so those were replaced.
Yeah, okay. I'm just ruling that out, because that was a big issue in the early Liberties, and they were literally falling apart.
Wow.
So, but if you're hearing this or feeling this more so underneath you, there are some links that hold the front suspension in. There are mounts that hold the transmission in. And I'm sure these guys have looked at all this stuff because, you know, you had a transmission change and other things. I guess, you know, over the radio waves here, without me seeing it or feeling it, can you reproduce this problem for any of these mechanics?
They've actually experienced it. So the mechanic took the car out for a drive, and he could actually hear and feel the clunk.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he had said that it was happening when he would turn. And now I'm also experiencing it just from braking at times.
Yeah. Yeah. Something's chucking in that vehicle. It's probably in its suspension somewhere. And it's just going to take some diligence to get that problem to reproduce itself. And then sooner or later you'll find it. And if you feel it's a safety issue, you need to press a little bit more to get it resolved rather than just wait till you know, something eventually wears out, which in some cases you have to do. But if it's a safety concern, you probably want to be a little bit more diligent on trying to get it solved. But
yeah.
but I don't have anything off the top of my head that I can say I've encountered on that vehicle that will fix it.
How many miles are on that, John?
About 128,000.
Is that common for a new tranny to be needed for that?
You know, we do a fair amount of work on Jeeps, and we handle a lot of Liberties, and I've found them to be pretty robust vehicles, and I haven't seen a lot of transmission issues, but anything can happen.
Yeah.
Could have run out of fluid, or who knows
yeah,
what, you know.
Exactly. Hey, John, we got a break here, but good luck, my friend. I appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is the number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. More on the way.
Support for WAMC comes from the Arkell Museum at Canon Johari. Presenting from Giverny to the Brooklyn Bridge, American Impressionist paintings from the Arkell Collections, on view from October 27th through February 2nd, 2013. The Blue Bonnet Diner, Northampton. Since 1950, offering breakfast, lunch, and dinner, banquet facilities seating 150, banquet menus, bar services, and dance floor, bluebonnetdiner.net. Adventure Outfitters, Hadley, Massachusetts, offering outdoor clothing, camping equipment, cross-country skis, snowshoes, climbing equipment, canoes, and kayaks. Open evenings until 9, adventureoutfitter.com. And Smith College Museum of Art, presenting Drawn to Excellence, Renaissance to Romantic drawings from a private collection, works from the 16th to the early 19th century, smith.edu/artmuseum.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Last one for this week. Tomorrow, of course, it's Moyers and Company, and then on Monday it'll be, well, I hope the storm hasn't hit by then. If we're in storm coverage, we're all in trouble, but it'll be a medical Monday on Monday. Of course, Sandy, the hurricane, is rumbling around in the southeast coast at this point. It's moving closer to Florida, so we're keeping an eye on things, and no need to panic. We'll tell you if you need to panic, but not at this point. Tommy in Neversink. Tommy, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a Camry automatic and 08. I live in the Catskills, and I often find when I'm pulling up a hill, it's kind of bogged down, so I shift it down to fourth, or in some cases third. And so I do a lot of that, and I've noticed not a lot of other people do that. Is that a bad thing for me to be doing? The reason I do it is because the automatic transmission really doesn't downshift fast enough to when you're going up an incline.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're not harming it at all. As a matter of fact, you know, those positions are there for the operator to use, but nobody uses them. You mainly just put it in drive.
Yeah, most people just stay in and drive.
Which you certainly can do, but those positions are definitely there to be taken advantage of. The mission of the car is to provide the best economy. So the computer is constantly getting the car shifted up into the highest gear it thinks it can handle for efficiency. But sometimes when you're asking for power, it doesn't downshift when you'd like it to.
Right.
So you push harder, and then bang, it shifts down, and there's a lot of noise, and now you're going too fast. So now... you can certainly put it in those lower modes and keep it in them if you want to. You know, coasting or a decelerating down a long, steep hill within reason, as long as you're not over-revving the engine.
Yeah.
You can pull that down at a speed, and it acts just like a stick shift car that you just shifted down, and it'll hold you back a little bit. It'll save a little on your brakes.
What if you don't have an RPM indicator?
Well, you'll hear it. I mean, if it's screaming, you know something's not right. You're over revving things,
yeah.
So you don't want to overspeed the engine for sure.
Okay.
Tommy, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend. Audrey in Del Mar is on. Hi, Audrey.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a relatively new problem, and I haven't had anyone look at it yet. I have a 2002 Passat, 155,000 miles on it. So every once in a while I have a problem. And the latest problem is sort of a whirring, windy sound when I start the engine, when I first start it in the morning. I don't know if I should do this on the radio, but it's kind of like, you know, that type of a sound.
How long does that sound last when you start the car in the morning?
It probably lasts half a minute.
Sometimes longer?
Well, maybe a minute at the most.
Yeah. Does it sound like a hair dryer or a fan going on under the hood?
Not so much a hair dryer. Maybe more like a fan, but it sort of sounds more like the wind.
Yeah.
Kind of like a windy sound, and it gets a little bit high pitched.
Yep. What you're hearing is what's called the secondary air pump. And that is an electric fan, a very powerful electric fan that's buried in the nose of the car, and it's there for emissions. The first 1 to 2 minutes after startup is the most heavily polluting time of the car, the engine. So what the car makers have found is if you blow a lot of fresh air into the exhaust stream during that period, it helps burn off a lot of that gas that doesn't get burned off in the engine. So it's purely for emissions, just to keep the air clean. As that pump gets older, it starts to get noisier, and you're hearing it more now. It was always there, but you're starting to hear it more. And on your particular car, and we work on these cars, sometimes they're incredibly loud. I mean, it sounds like a vacuum cleaner running for 1 to 2 minutes after a startup.
And does that mean it's about to go?
No, well, eventually it will. The pump is getting, the air pump is getting worn out. So initially you don't really need to do anything. But that's a normal sound. You're just hearing it more now as the car ages.
Okay, but you do recommend I have it checked and repaired or just let it go?
Well, initially you won't have to do anything. And it could make that sound for a long time, and it's not harmful. If that pump fails, it'll either blow a fuse or just quit altogether. Then you'll stop hearing it, and then shortly after that, like the next day or two,
the engine light,
your check engine light will come on.
Yeah.
And then you'll say, uh-oh, what's this? And then they're going to tell you, it's your secondary air system, and it looks like your air pump is gone. So, you know, you don't have to do anything right this minute. Eventually, you probably will have to.
All right.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Audrey, very much. It's Gordon Fricke's hour on the program, and Paul in Germantown, you're on.
Hi. I've got a friend with an 08 Volvo wagon, XC70, and it's got the digital display on the center console for radio and heat and AC, and the display has gone blank, and the radio doesn't turn on, but the heat and AC still work. We just can't tell what the settings are. And we took it to a mechanic, and he said, well, actually, some Volvos, they do make a repair kit for. Unfortunately, this one is newish, and they don't sell that repair kit yet, so the replacement is $2,500 is what we got.
Wow.
Yeah, that's insane. I know exactly what you're talking about.
For a broken radio?
We called Volvo, and they said they'd never heard of it. And that we have to bring it in for an estimate. So
yeah,
we just kind of put the brakes on things.
It's the display that reads the radio stations and the heating settings, the climate settings?
Yes, it tells you what the heat. So we can't see what the heat and AC are doing, but they do still work.
So they respond and warm up and cool down as you dial them in. But you're saying that the radio now does not work at all?
It occasionally will come on and turn itself off.
when it does,
very rarely.
When it does come on for those brief periods, does your display light up?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know if that aha was really anything beneficial to you or not, but
it sounded authoritative.
Yeah.
You know.
That there is the chance that you could get a used assembly, if your repair shop could get a used assembly, you know, that whole unit to put in there. And I don't think it's a coding issue with Volvo. Some cars' components get coded to the main computer.
Like the Cadillac. I can't just go buy a new one and put it in.
Yeah, right. In some cases, when you change a component, like an instrument cluster or any of the modules, sometimes they have to be reprogrammed to the car coded. I would maybe that could be an option rather than that $2,500 escapade. And
well, is going to a car stereo store and getting a $200 or $300 car radio, is that an option?
I don't think so. That car's too nice to hack up and put something like that in there. And that's the sound system in that car is so integrated. It's all built into you don't just throw anything in place of it.
Mm-hmm.
What you could do is get it to the dealer and say, look, we just would like to get a diagnosis only just to tell us what we're up against. Because they're going to want to see it and they're going to want to check some circuits. And to your possible surprise, it may not be that big of a deal. But the dealer isn't going to tell you that over the phone. You know, you got to get it in and got to get it looked at.
So maybe, in other words, a multi-pin plug or something that is loose?
Possibly.
If it comes back on occasionally,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right. It could be something going on behind it that's got a bad connection. I think I'd entertain taking it to the Volvo dealer and just say, you know, don't go crazy on it, but tell us what's wrong. Tell us what we're up against.
Okay, thanks for the advice.
Paul, thanks a lot. $2,500.
Oh, yeah, that stuff's brutal nowadays.
That is crazy. All right, Dave in Bloomingdale. You're blooming something. Bloomingdale, you're on.
Bloomingdale, New York.
Yep. How are you?
Good. Gordon, I have an 03 Nissan pickup, a Nissan, that I've been trying to get inspected for the last 2 months. At first, I was told it would need an engine knock sensor. And as a mechanic all my life, I put it in myself. It cost me about $200. The dealer wanted $700, I think, and $70. I went back. Now they're saying going to be another $475 for the evaporative valve and some other sensors.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm wondering, in the back of my mind, I thought I remember hearing something in New York State that you couldn't be charged more than $400 for pollution control
on
your car to pass New York State inspection?
It's kind of a strange, it's called a waiver, but it's really not your ticket pass go or whatever. If you have a vehicle that fails to pass the emissions part of the state inspection, the state says, okay, if you spend $450 against this problem and it's still not resolved, you can get a waiver for 1 year.
Oh, okay.
But you have to spend $450 on the repair.
Well, I'm going to probably spend over $650 so far.
Well, here's what you're up against with that Nissan. I am assuming your check engine light was on and you had a code for a knock sensor and a code for an EVAP issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I replaced the knock sensor. The light went out. It was fine, but then it came back on. So.
But is the knock sensor code gone and now you're only left with an EVAP code?
As far as I know, that's what the dealer said, yes.
Yeah, yeah. It was common on Frontiers to have both of the things that you're having happen go wrong. And the charcoal canister, which is in the back of the truck near the tank,
right. Yep.
Very commonly the valve assembly where it mounts to the canister cracks and splits apart, and you end up replacing both pieces together.
Okay.
Without me seeing that, but my experience with those vehicles, just replace them.
Right.
Get the light out, get the inspection passed, and then you don't have to worry about a waiver, because your next year you're going to have the same issue.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that knock sensor was no fun.
No, it's underneath the intake manifold.
Oh.
As you know.
Oh. Well, I learned a lot about my engine.
Yeah.
Thanks, Gordon.
You're welcome.
Yep.
School of hard knocks, as
you
it were.
You got it.
All right, let's go to Edward in Amherst. Edward, you're on.
Hey, how's it going? I've got a Suzuki Verona, and I think I've got a loose bearing. When I'm going straight, I get a lot of vibration, and then if I turn left, it gets really loud. but then if I'm on a right turn, it goes away. And I'm wondering, what's the risk? Is it dangerous? Is it something I need to take care of right away? That's my question.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. It sounds like you have a classic front wheel bearing failure or failing.
Right.
And the fact that the noise changes when you bear through turns is really the key into it being a wheel bearing, because the loads change on the wheel bearings as you move the car around on the highway.
Yeah.
So, yes, you definitely need to take care of that, because in extreme cases, that bearing can really fall apart and you're going to come to a nasty stop, or you could. And then it's time to get towed, and then it's time to fix the problem. Yeah. Anyway. So,
right.
So I would get it done.
Fair enough.
Is there a way to tell which wheel is the problem?
Yeah. The best way is the shop. What we do is we go drive the car, and then we think we know which side it is, but then we raise it up on the lift and put one guy in the car, bring it up to the speed on the lift that the sound is the loudest, and then we have a scope. It's like a stethoscope that the doctor uses with a point on it, and then we go back and forth to tell which is the really noisy one.
Mm.
Great. And one last question is, approximately how much is this generally going to cost?
What kind of car is it?
The Suzuki Verona.
It depends if they're press-in bearings, which I think they are. There's a little more labor involved in those, but I think you could probably plan on $200 to $300 a side.
Right, and is it recommended to do both sides?
Not necessarily, unless you got high mileage and the shop scopes them out and says, yeah, one is really bad, but the other one is right behind it. Then you need to do them both.
Edward, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks, bye.
Bye now. Let's go over to Roger in Poughkeepsie. Roger, you're on. You got a couple of minutes here.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Ray. Hi, Gordon.
Hi.
I have an 07 Saturn Ion, and just yesterday, well, it's got 118,000 miles on it, and just yesterday the check engine light came on, and the indicator for the coolant went straight down to the bottom, and the car seems to be running okay, but I was wondering if you could give me an idea as what I could anticipate when I take it in to have it checked out.
Sure. Now, you're saying the indicator, you're talking about the temperature gauge?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. And is that gauge staying low all the time now?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. What you have going on there is pretty routine. You're going to need a new thermostat. The thermostat is what regulates the engine's temperature, just like the thermostat in your house to maintain the temperature in your home. It regulates the coolant flow. And if it sticks open, which yours did, which that's the best thing to have happen, because at least you're not overheating, but you're running way too cold now. The computer is measuring the engine's temperature, and it said, we're running too cold, too long, we're going to turn the check engine light on. So that's what you got going on there.
Okay. I appreciate that. What's the cost for a thermostat on a car like that?
Again, what kind of car is it?
07 Saturn Ion.
Okay. That's a four-cylinder... I don't think the thermostat is in a terribly nasty location. That changes the price of the job due to
the part
the
is pretty cheap, right?
Yeah, relatively speaking. Although some thermostats now are up there, $40, $50, $60 depending on how they're set up. But I'm gonna say you're probably into $100 job, give or take. Unless I'm way off on the labor, but somewhere around there.
Okay,
I appreciate it.
Hey, Roger, thanks.
Thank you. Now I'm going to walk in knowing what's going on.
All right. Well, don't be surprised if it's a little different, because you never know. Hey, Gordon, well done, and a beautiful, beautiful 65 Riviera. Thank you for bringing it for us to see, and nice to get a test drive as well. Support comes from Sugarloaf Performing Arts Center, Sugarloaf, Orange County, New York, presenting Toots and the Maytals in concert Saturday, November 3rd, 8 p.m., sugarloafpac.org. The Digital Berkshire Eagle, an online newspaper for news and information of the Berkshires and beyond, noinkyfingers.com. Mass Match, a locally owned dating service connecting both straight and gay singles through private matchmaking in Western Massachusetts and beyond, massmatch.com. And the Albany Academy at Albany Academy for Girls, single gender education for boys and girls for nearly 200 years, hosting an open house Sunday, November 4th from 1 to 3 p.m., albanyacademies.org. Well, that's it for the show. Thanks for calling today. Sorry if you didn't make it through. We'll get you next time. At least we'll try.
Thanks to Zach Malloy for running the controls. Christy Carton answered the phones. Our producer, Patrick Donges. Gordon Fricke will be back with us next month. And do check out our Vox Pop Twitter page and check out the Riviera. It's quite a car. It's WAMC Vox Pop. Moyers and Company tomorrow at this time. Next week on Medical Monday, Dr. Ron Stram. I'm Ray Graff. Have a great weekend. Stay tuned now for a news update.